Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show on Voice of Vachon, located on Vachon Island, Washington. As always, we begin our broadcast with an introduction by our founder, Mr. Brian Brown. Our current Briefly panel includes Legal Beagle, scholar, and treetop flyer Craig Bellis, avid defender of justice, mariner, cyclist, and top secret engineer Kevin Jones, historian, professor, cool cat, and down under aficionado Bruce Holman, our big board pilot and real life pilot, morning DJ and reformed Texan Truman O'Brien, and I am Amy Dreyer, part-time politico and full-time shenanigans coordinator. And today we are going to talk shenanigans. We are diving into national and local topics du jour, and there is plenty in the news cycle to discover. So I would like to start on an up note and check in with each of the panelists about a favorite moment that you might have had this week. And since Kevin's out there on the high seas, I feel like he might have some interesting top highlights to share with us.
Well, since last week when we checked in, we've gone from Nanaimo to Ladysmith to a little anchorage on Prevost Island, which is a favorite. And now we're in Ganges on Salt Spring Island. And I think of Ganges as the place that most reminds me of Vachon of all of the places in the Gulf Islands. There's plenty of artwork. If you go down to Fulford Harbor, you can see the tie-dye contingent still strong in terms of 60s and 70s vibes. And so we've just been enjoying the waterfront ambience here in a little small seaside town.
Very nice. And since I am geographically challenged about that part of the sound, can you tell me a little bit more about where is Ganges and how many folks live there and when should I go visit?
Oh, well, you should go visit anytime. You'll need to find a way by boat, or I think they might have an airport on the island. You can fly in by seaplane, for sure. You might hear one of them arriving or leaving. Salt Spring Island is the largest of the Canadian Gulf Islands. Mm. It is just north of Sydney, British Columbia, and Sydney is just north of Victoria, both on Vancouver Island. So, yeah, Salt Spring is pretty much... runs just inside Vancouver Island in the Canadian Gulf Islands.
And isn't there a really cool little hotel, or it's just up on the hill above town? I'm trying to think of the name of it. I've stayed there, or I had dinner there once. It's fabulous. We were up there on our boat.
There is a hotel restaurant that I'm looking at. It's just right across the main Lower Ganges Road.
Yeah.
And they have a really spectacular dining room, and we've had a chance to have breakfast there.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the place.
So if it's a Canadian island and I come in by boat, is there someone I have to show my passport to when I get off the dock?
Oh, yeah. You'll have to arrange, coming into the country and then, of course, returning back to the U.S. But yeah, if you come into Ganges Harbor, you will probably put in at the Coast Guard dock. And as you walk up off the boat, one of the first things you'll see is the a restaurant built around a huge tree. And if you go into that restaurant, you'll see basically the trunk of the tree and the tree branches form kind of a canopy over the tables. You'll see Moat's Hardware, which is sort of like the hardware store before it was a restaurant on Vachon. Mm-hmm. But three stories and about twice the footprint. It's a really huge old hardware store. You can spend a good hour in there just wandering around to check out the stuff that they have.
Nice, very
and,
nice.
And, oh, by the way, the farmer's market, they have two of them per week now in the summertime. The true farmer's market is apparently crafts and produce. The other market today, this afternoon, is pretty much focused just on produce. And a lot of farmers on Salt Spring who bring their wares, and we expect to be there picking out radishes and maybe some celery and a few other items.
Well, I know I prickle when folks say this about Vashon, but it sounds charming.
It is. Nice. It's worth a visit.
Nice, nice, nice. All right, now, Bruce, are you still riding your high from the museum opening? What happened with you last week?
Yeah, well, the museum opening was a big deal. You know, we had Friday night, we had almost 600 people come through the museum over a period of 3 or 4 hours. Sort of rivaled the opening of In-N-Out being LGBTQ on Vashon when we had 600 people almost all at the same time and all dancing. This was a little more subdued than that. But it was still exciting. And I've gotten lots of kudos and lots of good words. So I think we pulled it off. So.
Absolutely. It's stunning. It's stunning.
Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you.
I have to tell you, I have to say, I have been to probably the monopoly. No, that's not the word I'm looking for. Anyway, some of the biggest museums.
The biggest and the best. The
biggest and the best museums in the world. I'm serious. Athens, London, New York, Chicago. And you guys, you're right up there. You're right up there with them, I'm telling you. Really
you
are.
You are, except you don't have the Rosetta Stone.
That's true. That's true. In the British Museum, yeah.
But we do
or the Elgin Marbles.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. But we do have Bruce Mercer's maps.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Not many people have those. Right. That's true.
That's right.
So, yeah, it was great. But appreciate that. Appreciate the good words. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. And Truman, what have you been up to?
Well, talking about boats, you know, I'm really, really late this year getting my boat ready to get in back cruising, and finally got it cleaned up. I even got the bottom cleaned, and I fired it up, getting ready to go out, and the port engine's raw water pump was kaput. So I ordered a new kit. I took the pump off, got ready to rebuild it, and it's frozen. So I had to order a new pump.
Oh, boy.
So here I am. I'm still dead in the water.
Still dead.
Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to the update next week.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I will have
it,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Hopefully not a continuing story.
Yeah, it won't be a continuing saga.
About September 15th,
exactly.
You'll actually get out
I'll
on
get
the water.
I'll get out on the water, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Craig.
You know, you asked for the highlights, the good things that happen. I have to start out with a bad thing.
Oh, all right. Breaking the rules.
I am breaking the rules. Of course, what, last Tuesday, I think it was like the hottest day we'd had. And that afternoon, our heat pump, which is also our air conditioner, went totally, you know,
kaput.
Bad.
Kaput. Kaput.
Totally shut down. And we haven't got it fixed yet. But luckily we had arrangements to get out of town. So we went down to Oakland, California, where the temperature was like 72 degrees and sunny every single day.
Ooh.
It was right in my zone, my temperature zone. Went down to visit my brother and his family, his wife, Sally, his daughter, Betsy, Annie, Vicky, and their kids, Julie, Sasha, Jasper, and Emmy. And, we just had a great time, until we got home just last night. So nice. That was a wonderful trip.
How many kids?
Well, Bob has three.
Yeah.
And then I moved down to the grandkids.
Oh, okay. Whew. I was gonna say, man.
It sounds like some families you know.
Yeah, it does, actually.
So that visit with family was wonderful. And today, right after the show, I've got some heating and air conditioning people coming over to the house to finally take a look at this heat pump.
So. Well, I will also look forward to your next week's update.
Yes, yes.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you how much money I probably had to spend.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah, well, speaking of, not my highlight. My highlight was that my wife was here all last week
cool.
The week before. That was just, you know, we get to see each other probably every month to 6 weeks. So that was, that just made my entire couple first weeks of July. But I guess speaking of mechanicals, I was able to sell an old truck that I had because, you know, if you're on Vashon, I think you are legally required to have one non-functioning vehicle in your yard or on your property at all times. Mm-hmm. So I'm now out of compliance there. But it is so wonderful to see it back on the road because, man, I love that truck. And people are texting me, hey, I saw your truck. And, I'm just really happy to see it back out on the road again. Little vehicle that had my heart has a second life on the island.
That's
so
great.
Yeah. I'll take that as my highlight. All right. So today, am I right? Is today July 16th?
It is.
Indeed it is. All right. That leaves us with 3 days until Strawberry Festival. Ooh, get ready. And Saturday, I think, is going to be some banner weather. So put on your sunscreen, leave your pups at home because that concrete is going to be hot, drink a lot of water, and come on out and have some fun. All right. And topically for the week, we are 112 days until the presidential election. And today in history, the most applicable important date that I could find is that in 1973, the existence of the Watergate tapes is publicly revealed in live testimony.
Whoa.
Yeah, so here we are again.
I remember that day like it was yesterday.
I kind of wondered. I thought that you might have some memories.
I was watching the television. I was painting the apartment that I was managing, and I was in it, but I had a television on in the background. And I heard that, yeah, there were tapes, and I said, and I thought, did I just hear that right?
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't believe it. I said, this could change everything.
And it did.
And it did.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
And it did until about, the year 2020, right?
Yeah,
it changed everything for a while. And then for birthdays, we have one of my favorite actors ever since Elf, Mr. Will Ferrell, who was born in 1967. And I thought, because it has come up before, that I would call out Ginger Rogers, born in 1911, the woman who did everything backwards and in high heels.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. So inspirational birthdays today. So we're not necessarily, I don't think, departing from the format of the Brown Briefly, but maybe circling back to it a little bit. And this week we're going to cover topics du jour. So we're going to talk a little bit progressive persuasion. And I think, I don't know if anyone would disagree, that at least there is a lot to talk about in our national news cycle right now. And a lot of historical things to cover. I think, on the internet's that meme that says, all I want to do is live in precedented times.
Yeah.
I think we're all yearning for some precedented times right now, but I thought we would get into some of our national topics today. And if we have some time, get down to some local stuff. But of course we had another historical event happen this past week, where there were shots fired at a rally for candidate Donald Trump, and all of the fallout and speculation and a lot of speculation around what that means. And I thought we'd get into some armchair quarterbacking about politics today and see what we had to say. And I did kind of want to start off. I like to be able to go over to Bruce. And, I think any good discussion is really well served by some historical context. And not that I'll say I don't know how much truly historical context there can be or comparables around this. But how does this site in the history of our nation?
Well, significant. And, it's interesting when you look at the nature of assassinations. There's been four presidents killed by assassination, but virtually every president, beginning with Andrew Jackson was the first president who had an assassination attempt against him. Virtually every president since Andrew Jackson has had some form of assassination attempt or conspiracy to assassinate them. So it's not unusual. What's unusual is that the shooter gets close enough to actually assassinate a president or wound them or shoot at them, and miss them, that's happened like in FDR in Miami, this assassinator. Shot five bullets, missed Roosevelt, totally killed the mayor of Chicago, but sort of similar to the Trump kind of thing. but the fact that assassination is part of American political culture, we tend not to play that up, but it's really very much a part of it, and it goes on all the time. And because of the Secret Service and because of law enforcement, they tend not to be successful, but they're there. the other fascinating thing to me, and Dolores Kearns Goodman talked about this, is how when people survive assassination attempts, it often changes them. Now, I'm not sure I hold out quite that much hope for our current Republican nominee or going to be nominee. But, you know, you look at Reagan was changed dramatically. George Wallace changed dramatically when he was an assassination attempt. Theodore Roosevelt, I mean, the whole concept of the bull moose came from Roosevelt, who was shot in the chest. And he happened to have his speech, which was multi-pages thick and a glasses case that slowed the bullet. But he went on to the convention and gave a speech, and it was an hour later before he went to the hospital. And that's the concept was, well, he was survived like a bull moose, and that's where he got the bull moose party concept out of it. So, but it changes people. And whether it will change Trump or not, that's just, it's hard to tell. He's already said he's changed his acceptance speech for the Republican convention. Now, when we hear that speech, I think on Friday, that's what's going to be interesting. Is it going to be Trump, you know, sort of trumped up, or is it? Are we going to see a real change in
maybe
the
maybe he developed a messianic complex?
You don't think he had one?
Well, even more so.
Come on.
So it is fascinating. But mm-hmm. I think any time you go through a life-threatening kind of experience, it forces you to think on it, or most people. And again, it'll be a test of Trump's character, assuming he has one, you know, what it'll do. We just don't know. But Friday we'll have a good indication.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that is a huge question mark. And I think, you know, in the wake of any sort of major assassination attempt, we are left unsettled, right? And sort of curious about the future. And I will say that I feel exceptionally unsettled and curious about our future. And Kevin, just from a, you know, again, purely armchair quarterback side of things, how do you see this affecting, and from what you've read and know, affecting Trump's base and affecting Biden's base? How are we absorbing this?
Again, this is a wait and see what happens. But my current thinking is, you know, the Trump base is as motivated as they ever were. I don't think this will deter any Trump voter from supporting the former president. For the Biden base, The thing that comes to mind for me is I think this assassination attempt, you know, is just one of a bunch of societal concerns that reinforce how really important it is that we support re-election of Biden-Harris administration. I think it's important we remember and emphasize, you know, the current administration's accomplishments, which really run the gamut from a strong recovering economy, record levels of employment, record number of children lifted out of poverty, significant reduction in crimes of all types. It's amazing, like murders are down 25%, rape is down 25%, according to CNN. The single largest investment in the climate ever. And like, if you go to the Switches On website at switcheson.org, you can put in your zip code and you'll find like all kinds of federal benefits to help us address the climate. This administration's made meaningful, but obviously not yet sufficient measures to improve gun safety and strengthening like our international alliances like NATO, who defended us during 9/11 and flew air traffic control over this country because of Article 5 of our NATO alliance. So I think that while the Democrats are, Democratic base is, of course, very concerned about a lot of things regarding this upcoming election and this assassination attempt kind of highlights some concerns. I think you need to recognize the Democrats are the only party who are going to hold the chance of retaining control of the political agenda. There's nobody else who's going to be able to sit in the White House besides Biden or Trump. And the Dems, of course, are going to keep working to reduce gun violence risk and promote the rights of all of us. So I think that's what I would hope the Democratic base would be taken away, is we just need to really continue to focus our efforts on achieving the outcomes that will be most beneficial for us in terms of our values.
And of course, you know, what this bumped out of the news cycle was the sort of perceived, and whether or not the media ginned this up, and I think to quite an extent, the perceived need to replace Biden as the nominee was dominating the news cycle. And this has kind of put this on the back burner a little bit. And I mean, that's a whole nother question that, you know, that we can talk about. That was kind of, you know, I think something that had begged to be discussed previously.
Let me suggest that, you know, Kevin, I agree with you, but those are all rational arguments. Assassinations are not rational. And people do not respond to assassinations or assassination attempts in rational ways. I think the danger lies there in that it is irrational. And the fact that Trump has chosen Vance as his running mate, who is the first millennial. He's very charismatic. He represents a different generation. He's a Trump wannabe, but at the same time, he washes up much better in some ways. And that's the danger we're confronting right now. I'm not sure rational arguments are going to sway the day come November. And I'm not sure Biden, you know, as he slips into his dementia along with Trump, and it's sort of a race to see who's going to get there first, neither one of them is presenting much hope for the future. And so you've got to look at whether we can dump, you know, Biden and find a candidate who can sort of pull in that different generation rather than the octogenarians that are already there. Or are we going to have a Trump sort of landslide, and then Trump, as he slips into his further into his dementia, you know, we're going to have J.D. Vance, you know, as essentially de facto president.
One of the things that struck me right away was that as they're putting Trump in the car, we have two people shouting at the cameras and you know, flipping it off and shouting derogatory stuff at the news media. Mm-hmm. Blaming the news media right away. So I think it really hardens that base. You know, that's the one thing that frightens me more than anything, is how hardened they were from that.
Yeah. And it's hard to know how big that base really
exactly.
is. That's, you know, I mean, polling is not a very accurate science anymore. I'm just interested to see what you think, Craig.
Well,
you come at it with a legalistic sort of perspective.
Not so much. I'm kind of hearkening back to my psychology study background. It's become a team sport. People like to be on a side now, almost more than anything else, and they want to be on the winning side, and they want to be on the charismatic side and the celebrity side, and you know, they think that I can identify with this particular person or this particular person, and so everything is existential. Everything, you know, everything is threatening. The one size way of life and the future way of life. That's a question I think you're going to get to in a moment about how do we de-escalate. But it's troubling times, to say the least.
Yeah. And I mean, Truman, what do you sort of think about what is the rest of the world looking at us and thinking?
Well, before I answer that, I have to tell you that I heard that there was some confusion on the dais there. Because after the first shot rang out, one of the agents said, "Donald Duck." Sorry.
I thought, Truman, rather than telling a dad joke, you were going to...
I couldn't resist.
Which some of us can identify with.
Yeah, sorry. I just couldn't resist.
I thought you were going to go into the conspiracy. Full and they're full-on blown conspiracy.
Yeah. On all sides.
Yeah.
On all sides.
Right.
Again, not serving us.
No, you know, having served in Europe and worked with NATO, I think our NATO allies were actually disappointed that the guy missed, to be perfectly honest. I think they're very worried about Trump coming into power and trying to pull us out of NATO and all of those issues. And in terms of our adversaries, I think Vladimir Putin was probably absolutely delighted that this occurred because he thinks it's going to make the base rise up and be even you know, more hardened and more to support him more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it's got to be, you know.
Yeah. And we'll get to Project 2025. And yeah, I kind of want to kick it back over to you, Kevin, because what we haven't talked about is policy, right? And truly, if you take 2025 at its word, we are moving more towards a dictatorship, right? Presidential immunity. And for the most part, democracy-loving nations don't enjoy it when other democracy-loving nations move towards a dictator model. And you know, kind of circling back to Kevin, what you brought up was policy. And, you know, Craig, what you called out was that we are now, you know, more voting on a cult of personality almost and who versus what. And, you know, Kevin, you talked a lot about the what of Biden. And we now know that there is a what behind Trump, which is 2025. But, you know, Kevin, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, a couple things before 2025, you know, it is a team effort now, as Craig said. And the polling analysis does show that there have not been significant changes in the polling. Now, there's still need to maybe let things sink in and see what happens. But yeah, I agree that the Trump base is likely to be energized. I think that all of the grievance policies continues to energize them. And this is, of course, another grievance policy. I have to say I'm really happy to hear that the person who was the shooter was not aligned with the Democratic Party, because you can just see what kind of chaotic propaganda would come out of that, you know, if that had been the case. But on Project 2025, yeah, there's some scary things in the plan. You know, Democracy in Chains is, again, a recommended book that talks about the Heritage Foundation and their goals to essentially achieve political and judicial dominance. It's hard to say that they're not being successful if you look at where we're at with the Supreme Court right now. But I'm alarmed that Project 2025 calls for like ending renewable energy programs and ramping up the use of fossil fuels. That's probably my biggest concern, because that policy results basically in really needless, a lot of global fatalities. The second concern and alarm point, if you will, is the elimination of any government recognition of rights for anybody other than white Christian nationals. So that's really concerning as well.
Yeah.
But I think we can be resilient by investing in community organizations who do year-round organizing and really support vulnerable communities. Organizations like Black PAC, Center for Common Ground, and in Cleveland, Ohio, Battle for Democracy. All organizations that really try to preserve those gains in our values that we've achieved over the many decades.
Absolutely. And yeah, we'll dive a little bit more into that, because it is something that deserves discussion now that we do have a what, right? We kind of had vague fears about another Trump presidency and the dismantling of our traditional structures. But I did want to kind of the Trump machine is very good at owning the news cycle, and I think that owning the conversation. So I wanted to take a minute and talk about the Democratic platform. And, you know, we do have a Democratic convention coming up, and with how quickly the news cycle is spinning these days, it feels like a million years away. But given there is a divide within the party around, like, let's back Biden, we need to ride our horse to the end, versus, hey, let's get someone in there who we think can energize a little bit more. As we look at the Democratic convention, and I will say I had the opportunity in 2016 to go to the Democratic convention as a delegate, and, you know, it did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was really define for me the why of, you know, why I was active in the party. And it helped energize me in terms of upcoming leadership in the party and reminding me what we stood for, right? Not just about, it wasn't about voting for who, but it was about voting for what. There were, you know, speeches at that event that I will remember for the rest of my life that I revisit, and, you know, truly set a policy agenda behind a who. So I'm wondering from the panel, if you were designing the Democratic convention and looking at the Democratic Party and thinking about what message they might be putting out there, you know, during the convention, with the opportunity to own some airtime, who should be chatting and what should they be talking about? Craig, I don't know if you had any thoughts about someone you'd like to hear from and what you'd like to hear them say.
I always have thoughts, but I'm not sure what they're worth. I would like to see, obviously, some of the younger leaders, up-and-coming leaders, showcased and have their opinions expressed. The issue oftentimes is, it's the leaders, the individuals who lead the country, who set the example. And by their behavior, not only by their beliefs, but by their behavior. And I'd like to see young and up-and-coming politicians in the Democratic Party get up there and really emphasize integrity and honesty and the values that people used to want to have in their children, that we considered the highest order of man and womankind. Now, that may sound a little frothy or esoteric, but it's not. That's kind of where it's at. Obviously, I'd like to hear comments about economic equality, universal health care, voting rights, equal rights, NATO, that sort of thing. But rather than constantly bashing the other side, I guess as a mediator, I see the divisiveness being increased. It's not that the other side, in my opinion, isn't wrong on a lot of issues. It's just that we've ratcheted up this division so high that we're losing, both sides are losing their objectivity. So I'd like to see some real cool heads.
Well, Biden, during his interview with Lester Holt, he was talking about, we've got to get more united. We've got to come together here, folks. And we've talked about this many times, about you have to listen to the other side and have good discussions with them about what you're thinking. And I completely agree. I think that's where we have to go. If we don't start talking, both sides of the aisle talking to each other, we're never going to get this resolved. I mean, we're just not.
Yeah, and to me, it's a Democrat sort of. There's two historic examples, two different roads to go down for the Democrats, and one is the 1964 Barry Goldwater, so extreme that that he lost in a landslide virtually, because he was so extreme. Will Trump in 2025 be the Barry Goldwater of 2024? Right. That's a real question. Right. The other direction, or the other road in the woods, as they split, if you will, is the 1968, when LBJ stepped back. Democrats sort of tore themselves apart in Chicago and lost big in the general election. Even if Biden does step back, are the Democrats capable of uniting behind a single candidate and running a significant campaign? And are they able to use that sort of 1964 Goldwater example of painting Trump and Vance and the Republicans and the 2025 project as so extreme that they're beyond sort of the pale of what American democracy is all about? That, to me, is going to be the issue.
Well, and it's kind of the opposite of what I was talking about. Do they need to go, point out the extremes and point out the differences, or do they try and work with the other side? I mean, it's, Craig, you're a mediator.
It's a tightrope, because you'd like to do, you'd like to get up there and just
bash
call it as you see it, because as we say in the law, God forbid you should have a client that knows they're right. When you're that self-righteous, you're just not going to communicate with one another. First of all, as you point out, you do have to connect. You've got to talk. You don't avoid individuals who disagree with you. And then secondly, you find in your classic mediation, you get beyond the dispute and you ask, what are you interested in? What are the interests here? For example, all this yelling about immigration. Mm-hmm. Is it immigration or is it jobs? Is it immigration or is it terrorism? Mm-hmm. Let's get to the things that you're really concerned
yeah.
about,
yeah.
and then maybe we can have a civil discussion because we're concerned about terrorists.
Well,
and we're concerned about, you know, these issues.
I think, Craig, you know, what you're used to is coming to the table with two parties who are good faith actors. And, you know, I think the real question here is if the, you know, 2025 driven sort of core of the policy team behind the Republican Party right now are truly good faith actors who will ever be transparent about their real goals, right?
Yeah, good point, good
and
point.
That is, you cannot have a productive discussion with someone who isn't transparent about their real goals and you know.
And you can't have a discussion with somebody who's irrational, you know, who's set totally in their ways. But what I'm talking about is more on a local and individual basis rather than on a leadership basis. I mean, it'd be wonderful if we had leaders who could talk to one another like that. But it appears that we do not right now. So I think, remember, we are the government. The people are the government. We're the people who run the country, who should be running the country. And we shouldn't just be a shadow of these figureheads that we've chosen. We can set the example. We can show. And I've had these discussions, and they're not easy, and I'm sure we all have, with individuals who are dead set against the stuff that we believe in. But if you have some respect, you listen to one another, and you can critically evaluate social media that's aggravating the situation, then you might have a step up.
But, you know, Craig, I recently asked one of my super conservative friends, I said, what, you know, tell me exactly what you want. What is the, you know, and they just, you know, they were just spouting the party line. You know, I mean, it's like. There was just no.
You got to help them. You got to help them get to the issue.
Yeah, but how? You know, how the heck do you do that when they?
I mean, we're confronting a period of very rapid social change.
Yeah.
You know, on all levels. I mean, you know, the internet and social media just exacerbates it. But the kinds of changes that have spun out, you know, in the last 10, 15 years in the United States, it just has a core of Americans scared to death. On both sides, you know, I mean, you know, the sort of liberals, if you will, or progressives are very, very fearful, you know, of sort of an authoritarian, totalitarian sort of state coming into existence. The right is very terrified of losing all kinds of privileges. And so you've got people who are scared to death, and that's why no conversations are taking place, because the enemy is a true enemy in most people's minds.
And we forget that
there's more things that unite than divide us.
Absolutely.
And it's finding those things that unite us and being able to build on them. And right now, it's so easy to find those things that divide us and so hard to find those things that unite us.
Kevin, I'm curious just to hear, you know, kind of the voice of the base, essentially, because I think you and I probably have a pretty similar take on, you know, the difficulty in having a conversation with folks who are basically coming from the perspective of what I want is for you to not be equal to me, right? And if you dig down deep enough, that's truly what they want. And that's truly where their, you know, their fear lies, is in folks of color, you know, LGBT folks, you know, women. Truly, that's their goal when you dig down, right? When you've spoken with enough and you've read enough about what their bases are doing. And, you know, where as a gay, how am I supposed to have a dialogue with you about that, right? Where am I supposed to split the difference between you want me to have less citizenship than you do, right? Where do I split that? So how do you see the base is having these conversations, Kevin?
Yeah, I think Bruce is right that there's a lot of fear. I think it's hard from being a progressive how to rationalize that fear. But Amy, the analysis that I've read says that it's basically people afraid of losing their position, right? That somehow that this dominant white male culture has been successful And they haven't always been polite about it. And there's plenty of evidence in history where we can point to things that we would maybe have regretted that happened. And I think there's a fear that, oh, they're going to turn the tables. Now all of a sudden I'm going to be the downtrodden one. And so in my mind, I think it's we have to model the behavior of what it is that we're seeking. And if we go back to the Democratic Convention, my thoughts there is what I'd like to hear is people talk about how we can continue to transition to a really a full, honest, multicultural, multi-ethnic representative democracy. And maybe the way to avoid the fear, and I've always thought that, you know, in progressive states like Washington and California, right, we can show how our values become policy, and our states don't fall off the continent. You know, we're actually probably doing pretty well in terms of economic prosperity and support to a whole range of different communities that otherwise and historically haven't had much of a chance. So in my mind, I think that regardless of where we are, we just have to continue to persist in saying, you know, it's not going to be, you know, that fear that you have is not warranted if we treat LGBTQIA plus people with respect. It's not warranted if we allow women to vote and to choose their own bodily autonomy. Susie and I were just talking the other day about when we got married, her bank called her about her credit card and said, we'd like you to change to, you know, like Mrs. Kevin Jones on your credit card.
What? Yeah,
they insisted that she do, you know?
What?
And this was not long ago. Yeah, this is in the mid-70s.
Oh, so okay. I thought you meant like recently, and I was going to place a call to Capital One.
that is recent.
What it was like.
Yeah.
And to show that we need to move beyond that and that we don't fall apart when we do. And so hopefully we can model that and be willing to open those conversations. It's hard to know where to start. I totally agree.
Sure.
But if we're willing to make the opening discussions, I think we'll be rewarded. I have been personally with some people who I consider very conservative, but whenever we run across each other, we say hi, you know, and we have respect for each other.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to move to Project 2025 and just sort of, you know, also throw in there, not to say that there are not folks of good conscience who are concerned about fiscal policy, are concerned about national security, right, who sort of bring traditional, what we would call Republican or conservative values to the table, who have grave concerns of their own around, you know, what that means, around what a liberal fiscal policy might mean. But Truman, go ahead.
I just have one comment, and that is I had a friend, one of my very conservative friends, who said, you know, Biden has just given our country away. And my question for him was, to whom is he giving it? And his response was, I always thought you were the smartest one of the group. Now I'm not so sure. And I thought, wow.
But what's the answer? But wait, what's
exactly.
the answer?
What's the answer? No, there is no answer.
Yeah.
And that's the point. There is mm-hmm. no answer.
Yeah. And I think as we get into 2025, we actually do see the true agenda, right? Mm-hmm. This is exactly. the most transparent the far right movement has been about their agenda in decades. And just to kind of set everyone up, if you're not familiar with 2025, it's a 900-page policy plan created by the ultra-conservative Heritage Foundation, led by former Trump administration officials. It calls for a dismantling of traditional systems of American government, including but not limited to the sacking of thousands of civil servants, expanding the power of the president, dismantling the Department of Education, sweeping tax cuts, probably not equally applied across the board, a ban of pornography, halting sales of the abortion pill, and further advancing state control of women's bodies, and a lot more. And just to kind of quickly sum up, I think, where the fear on the left is coming from around this, Kevin Roberts, Heritage Foundation president, and key architect of the plan, stated on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast, "We are in the process of the second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it to be." That's a terrifying statement for what has become a mainstream policy project, right? So wanted to kind of reset. And Bruce, can you kind of cite us historically. You know, we had, you know, FDR come through. We had Johnson take a swing at the Great Society, right? Cite us historically in this plan.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the culmination of almost 100 years of, you know, conservative thought reacting against first the Russian Revolution and the threat of communism, and then the New Deal, which sort of began to open up American society to a range of people who had been excluded up to that point. And then, you know, through the 1940s and 50s, you know, there was pretty much a consensus in government of moving toward, you know, government sort of responsibility for the economy, not in a totalitarian sort of sense, but just that there was a role for government regulation. And what begins to happen with FDR in particular is the beginning of this definition of how do we build a society that will not allow those things to happen. And the 2025 plan is a culmination of that 90 years, if you will, of anti-New Deal, anti-sort of expansion of democracy, anti-expansion of government responsibility in the economic sector. Not that it's a government-run economy, but that the government has a role in regulating, you know, untrammeled capitalism. You know, so it's not a surprise, you know, and I mean, you just need to read Heather Cox Richardson, you know, to get a real sense of how deeply ingrained this is back into the anti-slavery and slavery movements of the mid-19th century, you know, 150, 160 years ago. It's always been there. It's always been a part of the American political scene. And it's just intensified with the Reagan Revolution. I mean, Reagan gave it sort of legs that it never had. And what we see is in the 2025 report is a lot of things that were William F. Buckley and the sort of conservatives of the 1950s and 60s were talking about and what they wanted to see in American society. And now we're at a point where it actually has become a policy document. Mm-hmm. It's scary stuff.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for instance, dismantling the Fed and we may all remember that the Fed came around because for, you know, the stock market crashed and for 10 years we lived one of the worst decades of American history. But so speaking of agencies, Craig, would you like to kind of walk us through a lawless wasteland of no federal oversight?
Well, we haven't got to the point of no federal oversight yet, but there are real issues between the Supreme Court Chevron case and the 2025 document that talks about the dismantling of various administrative agencies. You know, we're talking about not relying on the technical and scientific expertise, oftentimes, and the financial expertise and the aircraft, you know, travel expertise, whatever, all of these things, and saying, you know, these people are, you know, too intellectual, and we don't want them telling us what to do, and the judges should be the ones to do that. Those are for the agencies that are left over that haven't been, you know, exterminated. And what you're going to have is you're going to have you know, the FDA, environmental issues, banking issues, consumer protection issues, labor relation issues. I mean, it's just endless. It just permeates every aspect of our life, where agencies have been permitted to make those decisions based upon their expertise and a check by the courts. Because we tried to have a balance of power between the three branches of government, but that balance has now been tipped dramatically to the courts and the executive, and away from the specific agency aspects. The other thing that's interesting, and I just should mention this, is the Chevron case, which basically says that the courts really retain the jurisdiction to decide what these agencies can and can't do in terms of their interpretation of federal law is going to result in a different application all over the country mm-hmm. with regards to all of these administrative regulations. In California, there might be one interpretation, and in Texas, there might be another. So you'll have a wide disparity. So it's going to it's going to be chaos. It's right. going to well, be dogs and cats living together.
It's much yeah. much more yeah. of the model of Confederacy, right? Which yeah. we decided did not work, right? Yep. Back in the day, a couple hundred years ago, and just you know, Truman, you dealt with a federal agency on the regular.
Yeah.
How you know? Walk us through. Imagine there were no FAA, or just sort of what was your experience living with a federal agency?
Well, I have a kind of a different look at this. For one thing, if you remember when deregulation happened of the airlines, look what happened. The airlines just exploded in expansion. Fares dropped. I mean, competition really came out. I mean, it was a huge deal. So that's kind of the other side of the coin, mm-hmm. where you have deregulation. It also, at that time was when all of the air traffic controllers were fired, and they talked about privatizing air traffic control, which the Canadians have done, by the way, and it seems to be working there. So you have those issues, but for me, the all of the procedures. The processes that we used in the airline industry were primarily developed by the unions and by the companies that they were working with. And then the FAA came along and said, okay, we're going to regulate those. We're going to make those, you know, policy. And so that changed the way those regulations came about. But the people who made the change, the people who instigated those changes were the unions and the companies working together.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't the government that did that. And in terms of the TSA, when after 9/11, what happened was that all of the airlines were mandated to provide the security, and so each airline or a consortium of airlines would get together and they would finance and support the clearing of passengers. Well. And all of us who were working in the industry at that time said, this is nothing more than eyewash, because if a terrorist group really wanted to take out an airline, they could do it. With the only thing that the screening is going to do is get rid of some of the nutcases and the stupid people who think you can bring a samurai sword on board an airplane. I mean, you know, but Keg Squad, yeah, why not? Yeah. No, but, you know, I mean, when you and the other part of that is, when you're doing the same kind of scrutiny of an 85-year-old nun from Kansas, or you are a 25-year-old gentleman of Mideastern background, you're equating those two, I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. Not to the people who are up in the front of the airplane, anyway. We're going, come on, you know. I mean, I had a tube of toothpaste taken away from me, you know, in uniform. It's mm-hmm. like, come on, guys. You know, let's get some common sense here. So, I've got kind of a different view on that. That we need to have the regulation of the FAA because you need that structure to put all these changes into some kind of a format that everyone can follow. But at the same time, you can't have it so heavy-handed that you can't get anything done, and that's often what happens. I will tell you one more thing. You know, the Juno is a perfect example. Juno had their approaches, instrument approaches that come into Juno. And because of the mountains and the situation there, you could only descend down to like 1,000 feet above the ground. And if you didn't see the runway, you were missed approach. You were gone. Alaska Airlines would come up and they would shoot 10 approaches if they had to. They'd go over to Sitka and get more gas and come back and keep trying. It was the capital. You know, it is the capital of Alaska. Whereas some of the other airlines would come in and they would make one approach and they'd say, oh, we don't see it, and they'd go on to Fairbanks or whatever. Well, Alaska Airlines was the company who began using GPS approaches into Juneau and developed that whole process of these, what they're calling RNP, Required Navigational Performance, or RNAV approaches. Alaska, as a private company, developed that whole system. The FAA has now adopted that program, and now it's nationwide.
Mm-hmm. So origin of the right idea from the private sector, but then standardized for the safety of all by a federal agency, right? And so, yeah, somewhere between unchecked capitalism and unchecked bureaucracy is where we want to
there
be,
you go.
Especially
exactly right.
when you're talking about the drugs that you put in your body, the airline that you're flying on, right? And so, you know, Kevin, what are your sort of big alarm points as you look at it? We've talked about the federal agencies, which is, you know, a little bit of a high-minded, but it makes a huge difference in our everyday lives in a lot of ways. You know, as you're looking at it, what are you seeing?
Yeah, the notion that we've already seen examples where judicial oversight of the of certain drugs is basically changing the history of whether or not those drugs are safe or not. I'm talking about, the abortion pill, mifepristone, and saying, no, even though those have been in the market for 50 years and we've shown the side effects are really very minor and lower than a lot of other drugs that people take on a regular basis, the judicial system in some cases has come in and said, no, we don't think that you should have that out there. Well, you know, it's a pretty patented display of their values being overriding true science and technology. Those are some of the areas that I really fear for, is that what we have is somebody's policy, in this case, religiously motivated policy, is changing the landscape under which we live. And then that they're basically would be imposing a set of values that are, in this case, fairly narrow and not supported by the public. Those are the things that are concerning to me about Project 2025.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's a sweeping change, Bruce. I think that's what... Sweeping change is scary.
Yeah, it is, and the fact that it attacks essentially the what we fought the Civil War over, the dominance of federal government over state governments, and the fact that there needs to be a uniform sense of citizenships and rights and elective processes, and breaking that up and trying to go back to 50 or more individual interpretations of each of those things, it really takes us right back to the core issue at the heart of the Civil War. You know, are we going to be one nation? Are we going to be 50, individual states, with 50 different ways of doing things? And there certainly needs to be a balance, and there's certainly a role for state autonomy, but there's also a place for national sort of regulations that are uniform across the nation. The right to vote, the right to citizenship, the right to be who you want to be, the freedom of religion. I mean, it's embodied within the Bill of Rights. And that's what's under attack to me. And that's what's so scary about the 2025 report, is it's essentially trying to drive a dagger through the heart of what we fought the Civil War about.
Mm-hmm.
Craig, what do you think? I mean, you sort of see that from a legal point of view, I think.
What do we got, 2 minutes
two
left?
Minutes, yeah. Solve our problems in 2 minutes.
Why don't we defer that question? I'm actually dying to hear the question about what changes would we want or in the festival.
In the festival?
I saw you on social media here the other day, and you take a lot of slings and arrows. You just cannot, obviously, keep everybody happy, but everybody wants something else.
Yes, it's a writ large, right? Yeah, and I do think just to wrap that up with the Heritage Foundation calling it a second American Revolution, I think it's a second Civil War, right, that they're calling for, right, is the Confederacy, and whether or not the left will allow it to be bloodless, that's chilling. Chilling. So it now seems pleasant to talk about festival. Yes, there will be food from off island. So let's do a lightning round. Folks, one thing that you, crazy as you want it to be or mundane as you want it to be, one thing that you would love to see come to Strawberry Festival.
Strawberries.
I was just going to say
strawberries. There's so many strawberries. There's not enough.
There are not. There are hardly any strawberries. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody asks me, why is it called the Strawberry Festival? There are no strawberries.
Maybe we should call it the Tesla
the Rotary. Rotary does a great job.
Yeah, the Rotary.
They do.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm thinking, of course, Euros. You know, I love those Euros.
You're going to get them.
All right.
We got Euros for you.
I got one that will be controversial. Horses.
Yeah.
We used to always have horses in the parade. We used to have Doc Easley with his giant Shire draft horses pulling a wagon, doing U-turns out here in the middle of the road with people sitting right in the sides of the roads. Times have changed, and you might blame my profession for that, but I would love to see horses again. The horse riders typically would train for weeks with balloons on either side of them and people making noises to make sure that the horses they were riding were safe to go down that down the highway, but stopped having horses in the parade.
Well, we can. That's not a liability issue. We can do it. Truman?
All I wanted to say is be sure and listen to and watch the parade. Mm-hmm. The DJs or the announcers for that are going to be my pal Craig and myself.
Absolutely. So on voiceofvashon.org. And Kevin, what's your wish?
Hey, if we don't already have a separate parade just for stupid bikes, I think we should.
There we have it. All right. All right. What a week. What a podcast for the Brown Briefly. So I am Amy, and for Bruce, Kevin, Craig, and Truman, we thank you so much for listening, and we will, quote unquote, see you next week on the Brown Briefly.